For Paramahamsas, for pure devotees, dharma means something else. Dharma means simply loving service of Krishna. But when you're dealing with the mass of human society, with the ordinary people, you have to deal practically in how to purify the materialistic propensities and keep people engaged peacefully in a progressive way. So Manu especially, Swayambhuva Manu, he deserves to be credited with being very, very expert in that field of knowledge. He wrote the Manusmita, which is the most prominent of all the Dharma Shastras. So he's a Kshatriya. Kshatriyas can be also very learned in religious principles. Nonetheless, as Swayambhuva Manu himself is going to show by the way he deals with the Brahmin Kardama, the Kshatriya must always show respect to the Brahmin. He must always give the Brahmin the priority, right of way. Because he needs, in order to function properly as a leader of society, the Kshatriya needs the guidance of the Brahmin. If the politicians, if the rulers do not have cool-headed, brahminical guidance, those who are for a king, that relevantly means how to organize human society in a practical way so that conditioned souls can gradually become Krishna conscious. For Paramahamsas, for pure devotees, dharma means something else. Dharma means simply loving service of Krishna. But when you're dealing with the mass of human society, with the ordinary people, you have to deal practically in how to purify the materialistic propensities and keep people engaged peacefully in a progressive way. So Manu especially, Swayambhuva Manu, he deserves to be credited with being very, very expert in that field of knowledge. He wrote the Manusmita, which is the most prominent of all the Dharma Shastras. So he's a Kshatriya. Kshatriyas can be also very learned in religious principles. Nonetheless, as Swayambhuva Manu himself is going to show by the way he deals with the Brahmin Kardama, the Kshatriya must always show respect to the Brahmin. He must always give the Brahmin the priority, right of way. Because he needs, in order to function properly as a leader of society, the Kshatriya needs the guidance of the Brahmin. If the politicians, if the rulers do not have cool-headed, brahminical guidance, those who are uninvolved in politics, they will be out of control. They have intelligence, but they'll misuse their intelligence if they don't take brahminical guidance. So that's why I introduced yesterday the proposal that we can debate the issue, you know, is this relevant to ISKCON? Devotees are talking about this. Even the GBC are currently talking about this. Whether the GBC should organize for themselves a Brahminical Advisory Council. Do they need that? So that's the question. If anybody's interested to discuss it. Yesterday I proposed it and I suggested think about it. So the question for debate is, does the management of ISKCON need separate brahminical advisors to guide it? Yes or no? Okay. Now, yes?
Can we extrapolate?
Yeah, you can specify, you know, you can qualify it. You know, it's a basic question. Especially, we want to hear reasons, you know, take a position, and you can qualify it. So you can say, well, you can divide between whether, you know, we need, whether the gurus or the GBC or anybody needs, you know, you can specify exactly what kind of guidance.
You can make, you know, but you should give reasons.
So, if anybody wants to participate in this discussion, what I suggest is I'll pass around a sheet quickly, and if you want to, you have something to say, sign up, and we'll give you an opportunity, a few minutes to say your words. And you can you choose your column, whether you agree with the proposal or you disagree, yes or no. And if you want to, yes? Yeah, put your name. If you want to speak, if you just want to listen, don't sign. And if for some reason you have arguments for both sides, you can sign on both sides, maybe use a pseudonym. Yes?
Well, for instance, I myself, I know that's something specific to say, but it's about this fixed and I may...
Yeah, so the second idea I have is after we go, everybody who signed up, after they all speak, if anybody has any comments to make, then we'll open it up. So we, first we'll let the ones who signed up speak. You want to catch me up? Okay, so we'll just do this quickly and then we'll start. It is just to wrap up verse 26 before we start. It's also mentioned, Lord Vishnu takes it, bothers to mention that Kanu's wife is also coming. So, we're not dealing anymore with the same world as we were when Brahma first started populating the universe. It was a world of sages and demigods. If there were any women involved, they were in the background. But now, Svayambhuva Manu, he's the first householder, in effect. And it's relevant that Manu's coming with his wife and his daughter. And it's family business. Okay. So if you don't want to say anything, don't sign. And you can sign up for either side, even if you're not convinced of it. You can just argue devil's advocate. And anyway, I'll read verse 27. Next verse. Text 27. Atmaja. Lord Vishnu is still speaking, replying to the prayers of Kardama. Atmaja asita panda gim vayakshila gunanvitam mrigayantim patim dasyat anurupayate prabho. He, Manu, has a grown-up daughter whose eyes are black. She is ready for marriage, and she has good character in all good qualities. She is always searching for a good husband. My dear sir, her parents will come to see you, who are exactly suitable for her, just to deliver their daughter as your wife. This is the Supreme Personality of Godhead talking to his devotee. So Manu, as Lord Vishnu is predicting, day after tomorrow, Svayambhuva Manu is going to visit you. He's going to offer his daughter to you in marriage. As Manu himself and the other sages and their Dharma Shastras explain, there are different kinds of marriages. Prabhupada discusses how in the Vedic system, girls don't independently pick their husbands. Girls are not just sent out in the streets to become prostitutes to go hunt for a husband. That's modern life. Even a respectable girl has to become a prostitute. She has to sell her body to get a husband. We think this is civilization, but it's not. So in the civilization of the Varnashram system, a girl is protected by her parents until she's married. And the parents take the responsibility to arrange her marriage. But there are different kinds of marriages that are sanctioned by the Dharma Shastras. The Brahma Vivaha, rabbinical marriage is the first kind. This is what's being arranged right now. Rabbinical. Maybe someone can mention we're having a class. Okay. Brahminical marriage means the parents arrange it. The father of the daughter is giving the daughter as a gift. You know, offering the daughter to as a gift to the groom. And along with the gift comes a dowry. Well, she's a gift, so she comes also with presents for her. The dowry belongs to the girl when she's married. But there are other kinds of marriage also. We hear about Gandharva marriage. Just like Krishna met Kalindi, Jamuna personified, and they just decided to get married. She said, I'm waiting for you to become my husband. And Krishna says, okay. So in a Gandharva marriage, the man and wife just of their own choice agree to become husband and wife, and they simply garland one another, and that's it. They're married. Then there's the Rakshasa marriage. Krishna also got married that way. His first marriage to Rukmini. When a prince kidnaps princess and has to fight off all the other suitors, there's a battle, that's Rakshasa marriage. And there's others. Pishacha marriage. Pishacha is a ghost, so that's the lowest form of marriage. If you just rape a woman in her sleep. I've mentioned also, it's considered abominable. It's not sanctioned. So, parents make the arrangement, but there are circumstances under which, not independently, but according to the principles of religion, the girl makes her own choice. Like a princess who's very exalted, she may be given a swayamvara. Not every king's daughter, but special daughters, specially qualified princesses, are given swayamvara. They have a ceremony where she makes her own choice among all the suitors. And there's also a description that a father has to get his daughter married before puberty. This is the rule. So, according to Manusamhita, if a girl reaches puberty, if she has three menstrual periods, if she reaches a puberty and waits, and three more months pass, and she hasn't, her marriage has not been arranged, she can go get her own husband. And her father, is going to have to suffer severe reactions from it. Anyway, the kind of marriage is being arranged for Kardama, the offering made by Swayambhu Ramana, this is a first class rabbinical marriage. So this sheet is sign up sheet for the debate. Only if you want to speak. If you want to speak, then sign. If you just want to listen, don't sign it. Okay, I think everybody has gotten their chance to sign. Anyway, we do have some on the north side. Okay, so we'll give everybody 4 or 5 minutes to speak, and then if anybody else has comments or rebuttals, we can, after we've gone down the list. But we only have 2 on the no side, and 6 on the yes side. Okay, so, question. Does the management of ISKCON need separate rabbinical advisors to guide it? Okay, so let's be polite in this debate. We don't need to criticize anybody in person. Yeah, but this is not the purpose of it. To
vent our grudges. We're trying to make a positive investigation into what's needed. So I can ask Nitai Ramdas if you'd like to speak for a few minutes. On the yes side, yes? Okay, you don't want. Yeah, okay. Your name was on the top. Anybody want to speak first on the yes side? And Mahaprabhu Das, maybe? I'm sorry, what's your name? Oh, yes.
I'm
from the nose side, Stubby Prabhu?
I don't think it's required because, first of all, there are all problems. So, you have separate problems. The other thing is, the Sannyasi are actually the leader of the problems. So, perhaps, the Sannyasi aren't qualified, that's another situation altogether. They were appointed by Sri Prabhupada originally, but it was appointed by Sri Prabhupada. And, you know, most of the board instructions that is to follow the instructions. So, of course, a lot of what I understood, they were from the rules of meetings, all the business of the business to be appropriate. The Brahmins and Sannyasis aren't qualified.
Thank you. Now we'll move over to the yes side again. Maybe Vrindavan Das Thakur? Yeah. Well, present your yes alter ego, and then they'll give you a separate chance to be no. Yeah.
Administrative versus an educational
back to the no side. Well, we don't have anybody else on the no side. You want to speak for the no's now?
Oh, you're okay with the no's?
Yeah.
No, in the sense that if you think that this kind of means chest pain, because my understanding that it comes in education institution, and the UBC itself should be a pervasively managed council, a council of problems, and should manage themselves the problems and the rest of the society the problems, as you were saying. And so if the idea of separating the educational versus the administrative is some idea of establishing Kshatriya within ISKCON, my understanding is that ISKCON will never lead in armies. To say Kshatriya means they have recourse to violence. Some people think that Kshatriya and ISKCON are always free because they're motivated people who really get the whole map. Home economics. Maybe like a librarian is around a temple, that's what they need to check it in the silver field. Check it for the violence. And my understanding is that will never lead armies, although they give councils and kings to do something like that. So as far as trying to keep in mind that it's about being an educational institution, then the separation may create, I can see the separation.
Thank you. You're back on the yes side. Abhidhuta Chandra now? Prabhu? Oh, yeah. Okay, we've used up the speakers from the no side, but if maybe anybody wants to speak again from the no side, repeat or rebuttal? Yeah. Is that no? That's on the no side?
Awesome.
Yes. Okay. Madhavendra Puri for the yes side?
Sure.
I will.
I'm looking for the equation between UDP and Guru. So, my understanding is that I've seen recently that GBC has much to do, especially when it comes to GBC and groups, they have so much to do. Basically, he has to put his hand in the integrity of the chakra of his respective tribe in Sardar. And on top of that, he has to lead and bring out his position in Sardar. So, I am mostly for the situation of the GBC and group. In your opinion, GBC should be more of the social type of GBC. You should be able to express an expert and give orders, encourage, rectify, lead, generous. Whereas the guru should be mostly focused, should be mostly focused on bringing up the disciples. I see many disciples of irrespective of gurus. Led themselves to their own problems, struggling here and there when it comes to them, because their rules are catching up with the time and travel all over the world, sending 2 days here, 4 days there. Many rules, even in bowling, for them, they have no time to take care of both of their disciples and also take care of their life. So, my understanding is that, as far as the old, this is my humble the GBC is the first master of the GBC.
Okay. In other words, in effect, then gurus shouldn't be managers. You know, what that means in effect is that gurus ideally shouldn't be managers also.
Yeah.
Is this, you know, that to that degree the functions should be separated.
Okay.
So, you know, to that radically, which would be a very radical thing for ISKCON, because most of our gurus are also managers. Yeah. Practically, it would take at least a generation or two, to, even if we chose to do that, to actually put it into action, it would take some time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry. Yeah. Is this on the yes side or the no side?
No,
okay.
It seems like when you bring it to this level, then you really need some clarification in terms, because do you need just initiating this can be manager? Because I'm a guru, and I also manage, and certainly the two collide. And I think all white shop are meant to be guru, so I think
yes. Can I make a comment? I don't think that even ideally, even as a proposal for the future, we should make it a rule that a manager can't be a guru. It's just that there should be an ideal established that traditionally, historically, gurus were just gurus. They didn't, you know, perform other jobs at the same time. It was a full-time job. So that's the ideal. In the real world, you know, other compromises have to be made. You know, so that, you know, in general, I think not all this has to be legislated and institutionalized. You know, we're assuming that what we're talking about is making a council, a Brahminical council for the GBC. It has to be something organized by the GBC, for the GBC. But there can be a Brahminical voice in ISKCON without it being something official. You know, Brahmins are respected not because of their political position or their money in their pocket, just that their word is trustworthy. So whether, you know, they're organized by the GBC or whether they just informally, you know, get together, that they can function just as effectively. It doesn't have to be an officially constituted thing. Legislated. Okay, we got a couple of speakers who haven't spoken yet. Father Leland Bartoli? Yeah, please. Yeah. On the yes side. Yeah.
Yeah.
sins. If I can comment, yeah, it's a natural process. It's not going to be useful to just decide we're going to say have diagnostic tests, test everybody, and then put a stamp on everybody. You're a Brahmin, you're a Kshatriya. Nobody will tolerate that. Devotees won't tolerate things being labeled like that. It has to be just natural. What needs to be defined is not to pick out who's which varna and just stick a label on everybody. But we have to define the different jobs. You know, this is what a Brahmin is supposed to be like. This is the activities he's supposed to perform and what he's not supposed to perform. And an administrator should do this and think like this and be like this and not be other ways. So that we define the jobs. And then we see who can do what job. Just like, you know, in a well-organized temple, you encourage all the new bhaktas to go out on Sankirtan. Try them out for the best thing. And those who can't do that, you find another job for them. So here we recommend the best thing would be a pure Brahmin. And if you can't do that, here's the other occupations available. A natural process. Okay. Thank you. Any time off for them? For the yes side. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, you can make this a rebuttal. Take paper.
I'm giving them.
Okay, give to everybody. Okay. You can make you can make your response to the no side first, and then make your original points after that.
The first point that some, I don't know if I caught them all, but the first one. Some of the first points was that everyone is a monk. And another one they kind of went together is that sannyasis are the middle of the class.
Yes. Yes.
For the first one, that everyone is a monk. In my mind it kind of neglects the fact that this is a preaching movement.
Yes.
And that as a preaching movement we have to provide service. Provide places for people to come, services for them to do. And also, our movement is for the conditioned souls, like you said at the beginning of the class. It's for conditioned souls to gradually become Krishna conscious. So we have to make arrangements for people to gradually become Krishna conscious.
Yes.
So, if we see everyone as being a Brahmin and that sannyasi was discovering covering that service, then it's hitting the preaching and making this, doesn't make room for people to fill those positions. You need to fill them because people need to be Brahmins, they need to be Kshatriyas in order for them to become a Krishna conscious in the future. And the other point against what I thought was do we really need Kshatriyas? Because we're more of a rabbinical movement.
And the Kshatriya means violence.
And the Kshatriya means violence, yeah. What do you do when you come to a city like Mayapur? And you're an Indian, but it's a discipline. Meet in the kid. You definitely, if there isn't already a Kshatriya class here now, in the future, as the city grows, most definitely will have to be some sort of Kshatriya within this to maintain the. But it's just get too big. So it's not just that we're a formidable movement because we're actually a view of changing the transforming the whole world.
Yes.
And those were my counters.
Yes. Can I respond before you continue? Or add something? So about how, you know, how can we have Kshatriyas in ISKCON? Because Kshatriyas have to be a proper Kshatriya. You have to use violence. Manusamhita says that the Kshatriya doesn't apply danda, punishment, and that means killing, then he's useless. Not only that,
Ordinarily, the kshatriya gets 1/6 of the pious credits of all the citizens. He's allowed to take 1/6 of their income as taxes. If he refuses, if he fails to ever be violent, to properly give punishment, then when he takes that 1/6 of the taxes, instead of getting 1/6 of the pious credits, he gets 1/6 of everybody's simple reaction and definitely goes to hell. If he simply fails to be, you know, to be violent. So then, you know, the question is, what do we mean by, not going to have armies? Maybe someday we'll have to, the world may get very violent. And Islam communities may have to protect themselves. The astrologers looking at the hands of the Iskan children. Look and say, these are all kshatriyas, these children. They're like all soldiers, according to their nature. So I don't know what Krishna has in plan. But even if there is no need for actual, warfare, self defense, it can be redefined what kind of violence. A kshatriya has to be able to punish. And a kshatriya is the leader of the community. He has power over, in effect, life and death of the members of the community. That's a kshatriya. But in a spiritual community, that can be modified. Maybe we don't punish any devotee with, capital punishment for serious spiritual crimes. But I think, the equivalent of violence in a spiritual leadership would be ostracism. The ultimate punishment is you're out of the community. We have nothing to do with you anymore. So that ostracism can be a kind of violence. It could be an effective punishment. And one who has that power over the community to decide who's allowed to stay and who has to go out, I think he can function as a kshatriya without actually killing anybody. Yes, ma'am? Yes, that's from the spiritual point of view. But if we're living in a larger society and a crime is committed, then the government might want us to turn over the criminal. So there are other levels on which criminal activity has to be dealt with. From the spiritual point of view, yes, you're free from going to hell. Don't worry about that. If you just chant Hare Krishna, you're relieved of your sin. But if you went and shoplifted and you get caught, then you're going to have to spend some time in jail.
Why not?
I mean, the members of the committee would have to agree voluntarily to accept that. You can't just impose it. Oh, that's the Bhakta program. you wanted to continue with your own yes proposals. Yeah, please go ahead.
Krishna is saying, according to the three modes of material nature and the work associated with them, the four divisions of human society are created by me. And although I am the creator of this system, we should know that I am yet the non-doer in the machine. So the first point is that Krishna created this system. It's not that it's actually created by Krishna himself, so there must be some reason to create it.
Yes.
So I'll just go with the other one. 1847. Sorry, I don't remember. It is better to engage in one's own occupation, even though one may perform it imperfectly, than to accept another's occupation and perform it perfectly. Duties prescribed according to one's nature are never affected by simple reactions. So, what Krishna seems to be instructing Arjuna to take up the role of the kshatriya. And Arjuna is a true devotee. So, Krishna is instructing his pure devotee to be faithful to his duties, then it seems that in our movement we should interpret it.
Yes.
Even if we don't need it, even if, okay, we're all practicing Vaishnavas, if we're not perfect yet, we'll soon be perfect, and a pure devotee is better than a Brahmin already. Therefore, why does he have to consider being anything else but a Vaishnava Brahmin? Still, Krishna tells Arjuna that, you know, yad yad acharati shvestas tat tat eve taro jana, the rest of the people are going to follow the example of the leaders of society, spiritual leaders. So, therefore, we loka sangraham evapi, just in order to set an example for the populace, we have to accept these material designations, because most people have to. Many people can't come up with a standard of sadhana bhakti. They can't follow that, and many people cannot follow the rules and regulations. Therefore, they can't nowadays. They can't fully join ISKCON. They're outsiders. But if ISKCON incorporates the Varnashram system, then there's scope for many other people to be participants in, according to their capacity. But they have to accept material roles in order to do that. And if the devotees accept the material roles, at least, even if they don't need it for themselves, at least to set the example for everybody else, that
makes it possible for many, many people, many more people to participate in Krishna consciousness.
What's the difference between ordinary Varnashram and Daivi Varnashram is that the Daivi element is that it's led. That Daivi Varnashram system is led by pure devotees. Now there's the intelligence of pure devotees directing the system. So when the devotees, those practicing pure devotional service, when those practicing pure devotional service participate in the Vedic social system, then the system becomes spiritual. That's Daivi Varnashram. Did you want to say something else? Okay. Anyone else want to add something? Yes, sir. Yes, yes. Yes.
And if you're talking about temples, then is a temple dedication institution like palaces?
Yes.
Or are the temples places for training and charity? Or will it just be an entire new element of this God, which is akin to the temple, which
yes.
is around other places for training and charity? But whether the DBC is going to have jurisdiction over that or not,
well, I mean, Prabhupada commented on that in 1974. He said that immediately every single temple in this country should establish a Varnashram college. But the temple should get in the business of training up Kshatriyas and others. It's Prabhupada's instruction. Immediately, he said. The Varnas and the Ashrams? Yes, except for there's limitations on who can be a sannyasi, vanaprastha, brahmachari. Only. Well, no, an initiated Vaishnava can become a sannyasi, but in the traditional system, only a Brahmin can become a sannyasi, not a kshatriya. Kshatriya can take vanaprastha, but not sannyasi. But yeah, if you've got Vaishnava Diksha, then you're qualified as a Brahmin. You're allowed to take sannyas, even if you weren't born as a Brahmin. That's okay. But anyway, the traditional system is sannyas is only for Brahmins. Vanaprastha is only for Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Brahmacharya is only for the three classes that have sacred thread initiation. You know, the Shudras who don't take Upanayanam, they don't become Brahmacharis. Brahmachari life begins with Upanayanam, actually. And then Shudras is only one ashram, Grahastha ashram. Yeah, but it's not the Shudras.
Right, but yeah.
Even among the Brahmins, there are variations, just like, you know, some of the caste Goswamis in Vrindavan. You know, the families are the family heads are the Acharyas. And they get the sons all get initiation. It's part of, you know, entering the family business. But, you know, they shave their heads and that's it. You know, they're Brahmachari for one day. Yes. Well, Kshatriya spends a few, you know, several years, maybe not as many years as a Brahmin in the Gurukul, but he goes to Gurukul for several years also to get a thorough training. Kshatriyas need thorough, you know, spiritual discipline to become proper Kshatriyas. So Lord Ramachandra went to Vashishtha Rishi's ashram for several years. They were teenagers by the time they finished their education. The Brahmin spends more time. If you want to get complete Vedic education, if you want to study all four Vedas, 12 years for each Veda, 48 years in school. That's actually mentioned in Dharma Shastra, theoretically. You know, the limit for Vrindavan education is up to 48 years. Okay. Yes?
I had a couple of comments.
Please.
See, first thing is that the way the question is formulated, I'm not sure if that's the right or wrong way to formulate it.
Okay.
Municipal managers need a separate Brahminical body to guide them.
Yes.
So it's not really clear what is separate from what. As far as I understand, one aspect of this issue which has been discussed is the role of the GBC itself.
Yes.
Some people say that just like Prabhupada shifted from having only Vyasa to GBC, and then doing sannyasis, and there are letters in which he says, now only I want the GBC to do as I'm doing, traveling and teaching,
yes.
Like a Brahminical role.
Yes.
So one side of the issue saying that the GBC itself should just be a Brahminical role, and then managing should be something below the GBC. Some other type of body, some other type of some other type of definition. Also due to the fact that Prabhupada also apparently spoke about the limit of the number of GBCs that we should have, and practically it would be just too much, the zone would be just too big, too large for few
downstairs.
For future GBCs to manage.
Yes.
So it seems that the issue actually is that the role of the GBC itself should be a Brahminical.
Yes.
I never heard this.
Well, sure. No, I mean, Prabhupada wanted that the GBC be Brahminical, but I have to ask, can it be? Yeah. Maybe 100 years from now, but in the world we're living in now, the Islam we're living in now, can the GBC all of a sudden turn it into itself into a Brahminical body? I don't think it can. I think it's too caught up in managing it.
That's another issue.
Who's going to manage?
The question of job description.
Yeah.
The other issue is that sometimes I found that there is this, we take for granted, or almost for granted, that manager is a chatter.
Right.
Sure, can be a vice.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah, that's the point I want to talk about.
Okay. No. The question is better rephrased. I mean, the real issue is we need Brahmins and Kshatriyas. We don't have anybody trained up properly to perform those functions purely. We have an institute of the training for it. Even if you have the nature of a Brahmin or a Kshatriya, you don't become one without proper training first.
What's your point? That
what's really needed is a beginning of establishing an educational system. You know, define these varna occupational functions, define the jobs, and then develop education, training for those jobs. And that's a very long term job. You know, define these varna occupational functions, define the jobs, and then develop education, training for those jobs. And that's a very long-term job. So anyway, in the long run, I think that's what's required, is developing, understanding what's needed and then developing the training necessary for that. And then you may get, 50 or 100 years from now, you may get people who can actually have been trained up and can perform the functions. And I'm agreeing with you that it's not a simple question of, you know, something the GBC is going to do right now and solve the problem. Yes. The Brahmins have to understand what's a Brahmin, what's a Kshatriya, and the Brahmins have to train up the Kshatriyas. Then the Kshatriyas can do everything else, organize everybody else. The Brahmins have to create the Kshatriyas. Yes. But there are devotees, or there are those who would like to be devotees who can't chant 16 rounds, can't follow four regular principles, can't pick up a book, but they'd like to work for Krishna. So someone who doesn't read, who doesn't chant, who wants to do some service, in effect, that's a Shudra. Yes. 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 But in each individual, that has to develop gradually. So some people are very much covered by the mode of ignorance, and it's going to take them some time to come up to the proper standard of sadhana bhakti. Maybe in this lifetime they can't. Maybe in this lifetime they may not be ready for real initiation. Maybe initiation shouldn't be given out so cheaply to those who can't. You know, initiation is being given out nowadays to devotees who don't even know what the four regular principles are. Yeah, what is speaking of being able to follow them? You know, many grihasthas, nobody ever told them about garbhadhana samskara. Yeah, so, I would think Shudra is somebody who's not ready for initiation. Prabhupada did say, if you go 7 years without getting initiation, then you're a Shudra. If you're practicing devotee but you don't take initiation for 7 years, you should consider yourself a Shudra.
But
then
if you don't come to the standard of initiation,
yes.
Not because you
do,
you're a Guru,
no, even
11 years.
Yes. Well, but it's also a matter of developing faith. If you may be following the principle, but you don't have enough trust to take initiation to accept a guru, then that's also a weakness. I think he included that. I think he meant to include that. You know, that someone who can't put his trust in anybody, even after 7 years of practicing, that's a lower standard. There's something wrong with your faith. Yes. I probably said as soon as I met my guru, I accepted him as my spiritual master. Okay. So
he was ready for it.
Yes. Yeah. No. Not that we should label. So, you know, okay, you've been hanging around for 7 years. You're a Shudra. I don't mean like that. Yeah. But Prabhupada did make the statement. Yes. Why? Yeah. It's not even necessary to tell anybody you're a Shudra. You know, don't use the labels then. Maybe in a few generations, it'd be respectable to be considered a Shudra. Nowadays, nobody wants to, you know, nobody will want to be called a Shudra. So, okay, don't call anybody a Shudra. But if someone can't follow principles but wants to work for Krishna, let him, you know, encourage him. Sure. Sure, he can become elevated by practicing Krishna consciousness in this lifetime. We have a half hour left. Maybe we can go back to the lesson plan. Otherwise we'll fall behind. Alright, thank you very much.
Torchlight.
Wow.
You light it, you yeah. Get the battery from Mathura. Look how it looks.
It's really nice.
From
Mathura.
Look, Peter.
Wow.
Where are you going now?
I'm going to read this, okay? So listen,
and then what?
Then we'll go on. We're going to read text 27. Okay. We can continue this discussion again, you know, but for today, let's read a few verses. And we read 27 already. So text 28. Lord Vishnu is still talking to Kardama. Samahitam te vidayam yatreman parivatsaran satvam raman vipavadhu kamam ashu bhajishyati. That princess, O holy sage, will be just the type you have been thinking of in your heart for all these long years. She will soon be yours and will serve you to your heart's content. Anyway, Kardama has taken a humble position. He's honest enough to just admit his embarrassing predicament. And Lord Vishnu is pleased to give him what he's been desiring all along. Prabhupada comments, God, a man proposes, God disposes. Kardama just wanted a wife, that's all. Give me some wife, suitable wife, whatever that is. But because he took his material desire and laid it at the feet of the Supreme Person, Lord Vishnu gave him fulfillment of his desire way beyond his expectations. He gave him, you know, a first-class princess for his wife. So, therefore, Prabhupada concludes in the purport, we should depend on the Lord's choice. We have material demands in our heart, in our mind. Offer them to Krishna. Let Krishna figure out the solution or the fulfillment of our desires. Let him make the choice. That's the best solution to dealing with material attachment. Then Prabhupada discusses toward the end of the purport about inter-caste marriage. That, we have to separate the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. Brahmins and Kshatriyas have different occupations. They even live in different places. In a Vedic city, there'll be a neighborhood where the Brahmins live. The kings, you know, will live in the palaces and the royal neighborhood. They'll be separated physically. But there is intermarriage between Brahmins and Kshatriyas. That's allowed here. Kardama is being offered a Kshatriya girl. That's allowed. A Brahmin boy can marry a Kshatriya girl, but generally, the other way around is forbidden, generally, or is considered not proper. A man should marry a wife who is equal to himself or inferior, not one who is materially superior. It doesn't work. The psychology doesn't work well. To have a wife who is materially smarter than you or higher class than you. And it's considered, it's called pratiloma. Anuloma is with the grain. You comb your hair, you know, in the direction the hair grows. If you comb your hair backwards, then it gets all messed up. It's pratiloma, against the grain. When a Kshatriya marries a Brahmin woman, that's against the grain. What's the result? What are the children of a a marriage where the man is a Kshatriya and the woman is a Brahmin? Sutta, yeah. So Sutta, that Sutta is a mixed class. Pratiloma. Sutta Goswami talks about himself as Pratilomaja. You know, I was born against the grain. Because he was born in the Sutta class. And Sutras have, and each of these, there are, I think because you have four major martyrs, you have 16 basic mixed classes. It's permutation, mathematical. So among them are the Sutras, sons of originally born from a Brahmin father and a Kshatriya father and a Brahmin mother. And then their further descendants, those who were born of Sutras, remain Sutras. And the Sutras have specific occupation. Chariot drivers, and what else? Reciters of Puranas. Sutta Goswami, that was his family's occupation. His father, Roma Harshma, was appointed by Vyasadeva to be the professor of the Puranas and the Itihasas. He was disposed of by Lord Balaram at Mahavishwaranya. And his son took his father's position on the Vyasasana at Mahavishwaranya, Ugra Shravasutta. That was the family occupation. They weren't chariot drivers, they were reciters of Puranas. Whereas Karna was adopted by Adirata, who was a chariot driver. So he was considered a Sutta, but his occupation was driving chariots. That's mixed, Pratiloma, against the grain. But in this case, Kardama is going to marry a girl who's the next lower class, and that's okay, no problem. Prabhupada mentions the case of Yayati. Shukracharya's daughter wanted to marry Yayati. Yayati at first refused. I'm a king. She's the daughter of a sage. This is not proper. But Shukracharya said, no, do it. So with the special sanction of the father, this exceptional arrangement was made. That Yayati entered a Pratiloma marriage. And there was trouble. They ran into trouble. Yayati ended up getting divorced. He lost his youth. Okay. So anyway, now we're being introduced to Devahuti, the daughter of Swayambhuvananda, mother of God, mother of Lord Kapiladev. In text 29, Lord Vishnu predicts how she'll beget 9 daughters. Yes? Yeah, a woman, okay, according to Dharma Shastra, a woman doesn't have her own caste. She as a girl, she has the caste of her father, and when she gets married, she takes on the class of her husband. So the wife of a Brahmin is a Brahmini. Okay. Text 29. Yatha atma britam viryam navada pasavishyati virye. Padiye Vishaya Adasyanti Anjasat Manaha. She will bring forth 9 daughters from the seed sown in her by you. And through the daughters you beget, the sages will duly beget children. So this in itself is fulfilling the order of Lord Brahma and helping the pastimes of Lord Vishnu to create and populate the universe. These 9 daughters of Kardama and Devahuti will marry the other principal Prajapatis. There wasn't that many qualified begetters of children available at that time, at the beginning of Brahma's day. So this is very significant, very important function they're going to perform. They're going to be mothers who are going to begin the great lines of kings, of demigods, of sages, and even of the different species of animals. These nine daughters of Daksha, and then another of Kardama, and then Daksha will have many daughters, I think 22 or so daughters, who will marry the other Prajapatis. Kashyapa will marry 13 of the daughters of Daksha, and all the different species of life will be their children. 29. Okay, so Nabada, it's described later on that Kardama Muni literally expanded himself into nine, and he impregnated his wife simultaneously in nine different forms. And that way, she had nine daughters. A very competent yogi can do this. He can expand his body nine times. Krishna expanded himself 16,108 times, and went home every night to each of his wives in a separate palace. And each of those nine 16,108 Krishnas were doing different things at the same time. Whereas a yogi can expand himself up to nine times, usually is the maximum. And each of those forms is basically just like a television image of the same person. They can't really perform separate functions. That's the limitation of a jiva. That's the best a jiva can do. Make nine clones of himself. So, by yogic power, by the power of his austerity and discipline, Kardama is able to engage this sexual energy in a constructive way. Controlled sex means good children. When sex is not just indulged in for sense pleasure, when it's used for the purposes of fulfilling one's duty in life, then the children are good. They become useful members of society. And Lord Vishnu is glorifying the daughters that are going to be born. So girls can also be auspicious. It's not just that only boys are auspicious offspring. Nowadays, medical technology has advanced, so in India you can go in almost any city, you can go get the ultrasound test to see whether your child's going to be a boy or a girl. And if she's a girl, you can kill her. So that's a very common thing nowadays in India. Just find out, and then if it's going to be a girl, just dispose of it. So these are the sins of the modern age. But in a civilized society, girls are also honored. Their value is also respected. Okay. Can we go on to the... Any questions or comments? No? Okay, text 30.
Tvam cha samyag anushtaya nidesham ma ushattamaha mai kirti pitashita priyato ma bhavasyase.
Okay, now Lord Vishnu is going to switch the topic again. Okay, we arranged the marriage, that's taken care of, your desires are fulfilled. But now we'll discuss how you're going to attain spiritual perfection after that. So Vishnu then says, with your heart cleansed by properly carrying out my order, my command, resigning to me the fruits of all your acts, you will finally attain to me. In other words, Lord Vishnu is promising Kardama he's going to go back to Godhead. In this lifetime, he's going to attain love of God. So
Mai Tirti Krita Shesha Kriyarataha.
The word Tirta Prabhupada points out in the purport means a holy place, a pilgrimage, a sanctified, or he specifies. Prabhupada says, Tirtha means a sanctified place where charity is given. As in the first canto, chapter 13, when Vidura comes back home after wandering around in pilgrimage, he had been insulted by Duryodhana and left home. Now he's coming back after the Battle of Kurukshetra, after the Yadus have killed one another, and Krishna has actually left the planet. Now Vidura is coming home. And Yudhishthira greets him. He asks him, you know, how was your pilgrimage? How did you find the holy places? Where did you go? And then before Vidura answers him, he says, well, anyway, it doesn't really matter. You know, you don't have to tell me your whole itinerary. Bhavad vidha bhagavata tirti bhuta swayam vibho tirti kurvanti tirtani svamkatsena gada vita. Great persons like yourself, Uncle Vidura, are yourselves real holy places. You go to these sacred places and you re-sanctify them by your personal presence. Because you have Lord Gadabhita, Krishna, the wielder of the transcendental club, Kaudomiki, in your heart. So you come to these places carrying Krishna in your heart, and so many pilgrims have been visiting, bringing their, depositing their sins in the holy waters. You come and re-purify, and you make them back into holy places. You are the actual walking or mobile tirtha. Kardama Muni also is like that. You will offer everything to me, resigning to me the fruits of all your acts, is the statement in the verse. Everything. Kardama is engaged in meditation. His meditation is an act of devotional service, so he's engaged in pure spiritual activity. At the same time, he's also engaged in material activity. He has the responsibility to help populate the universe. That means get married, take care of your wife, take care of your children. Now, material activity is involved. But all of that must be performed in Krishna consciousness for it to be actually successful. And even, Prabhupada discusses in the purport, even welfare work for one's family, society, country, humanity at large, all of that should be performed in Krishna consciousness, under the direction of the Supreme Lord and His representatives. So Prabhupada has made the point that we should do everything for Krishna, including our material duties, and in order to do that, we have to be acting under the direction of Krishna and of Krishna's representatives. So it's very important that what our activities, our behavior, has to be in line with the instructions of the acharyas. If not, then there'll be all sorts of disturbances and disappointments. This is my comment, not Prabhupada's. We can have a strong desire to become Krishna's devotees. We may have a strong taste for chanting Hare Krishna, but if our behavior is not up to a civilized standard, if we're not following the specific instructions of Prabhupada and his predecessors, then there's all sorts of trouble. Especially if we're full of doubts and we're wasting our energy fighting and criticizing one another, that destroys any sense of Krishna conscious community. Doubt and criticism and conflict. That's the importance of having Brahminical culture. When the Brahmins are there and everybody trusts what they have to say, then that pacifies the human society. Then there's not so much unnecessary quarreling. Then there's a mood of trust. Now, let the Kshatriyas be passionate. Let the Vaishyas be greedy. That's the way they are. But if you have some men who are above that, then that, you know, creates trust and a willingness to accept authority in society. And without that, without a willingness to accept proper authority, then human society is not civilized. Okay. Any questions or comments? Okay. So the point here is that Kshatriyas need the guidance of Brahmins. Human society, the whole society needs Brahmins to guide them. But especially the ones who are doing the ruling, they need personal guidance. They have to have a very intimate relationship with the Brahmins, and they have to be the disciples. The Brahmins have something to say, and the Kshatriyas should be listening. So I have some quotations from the Vedas on this point, that the Kshatriyas especially need to be guided by the Brahmins. Okay. Some of them I have the Sanskrit, some I just have translation. Again, from that Shatapatha Brahmana, the explanatory commentary on the White Yajurveda. So the statement in chapter 26 of the Shatapatha Brahmana, that a Brahmana may remain without a king, but a king should never be without a Brahmana. Brahmins can just live out in the forest. They can live an anarchistic life. They don't need to be ruled. But a king without a Brahmin to guide him is not a proper Kshatriya. Okay. Then going back to the Rig Veda, right from the Rig Veda Samhita, fourth mandala, chapter 50.
Sa ikshayati sudita okasi swetasmai ila pinvate vishwadani tasmai visham swayam eva namante yasmin ramha vajani purva eki.
That king dwells in full satisfaction in his own residence. For him, the earth is always fruitful, and to him, the citizens spontaneously, voluntarily bow down. That king who keeps in front of himself the Brahmins, the king who is always faithful to Brahminical culture, who honors the Brahmins and takes their advice. He's satisfied. The earth is prosperous. The citizens voluntarily submit to him. Okay, that's a Rig Veda. So, you know, it shouldn't be said that the Vedas don't discuss the Varnashram system. It's right there. It's just not, you know, chapter by chapter in systematic order. But there's plenty of information about the Vedic social system in the Vedas. From the Aitareya Brahmana, the explanation of the Rig Veda, chapter 8 of the Aitareya Brahmana.
Tadyatra vai brahmana kshatram vasham eti tadrashtram samvidam tadviravad ahasmin viro jayate.
In that kingdom where the Brahmins have control over the Kshatriyas, there is prosperity. That kingdom is heroic, a place where heroes are born. And again from the Shatapatha Brahmana, fifth chapter, part 4.
Yo vai raja brahmanad abaliyan amitrebyo vai sabaliyan bhavati.
Okay. or for everybody? Not everybody.
No, only king.
No, everybody. The king who is not powerful toward the Brahmins, in other words, who is humble to the Brahmins, becomes very powerful to his foes. So if the king, in other words, if the king is respectful to the Brahmins, then he gets the strength to defeat his enemies. Okay. Then another topic that I have a few verses, quotations on, is the idea that Brahman is always superior to the Kshatriya. Okay. So, also in the original Vedas, Taittiriya Samhita, that's the Vaishnavas associate themselves with that branch of the Black Yajurveda. So in the Taittiriya Samhita, chapter 2, the statement,
Brahman eva kshatram andaram vayati tasmad brahmano mukyo mukyo bhavati.
The Brahmana places the Kshatriya behind himself. He assumes a superior position. Thus, the Brahman is most important. He is born from the mouth of Brahma. And then in the Aitreya Brahmana,
Bhuyan vai Brahmana kshatriyad iti Varuna uvacha.
Varuna has said that the Brahman is superior to the Kshatriya. Brahman, and from the Tandya Brahmana that belongs to the Samaveda,
Brahman hi purvam kshatrat.
The Brahman has priority over the Kshatriya. So that's a basic principle of the Vedic system. Yes.
What is the they must have some practical independence, like Kshatriya. What is he actually controlled by? Like, he must have some practical administration that he doesn't. Like every single
actor. No, that's up to him. I mean, he should maintain, the king should maintain a brahminical council of advisors. And whenever he's doubtful about the right thing to do, then he asks them. But it's not that he has to, ask them, how to brush his teeth and every little thing.
But it's specifically for spiritual functions?
No, practical things. But, the day-to-day functioning of a kshatriya is a matter of executing the principles of religion, dharma. It's not just politics. It's Brahman. A kshatriya lives to defend and promulgate dharma. So if there's any question about what's dharmic, what's the right thing to do, he has to go to the Brahmins if he's in doubt. Anyway, the minimum is every day when the Kshatriya wakes up in the morning, he has to offer respects to the Brahmins. One of the first things he does in the morning before he brushes his teeth is pay respect. That's the minimum. You have to at least show respect to the Brahmins in the morning. And maybe if you go the whole day without having any questions, okay, but you still have to make that show of offering respect. But he can't, Kshatriya can't perform a sacrifice without consulting and engaging the Brahmins. There's not much he can do without involving himself with the Brahmins. Practically, he can't go a whole day without consulting. Okay, anything else? Okay, so it's time we can stop here. Thank you all. Glorious to Srila Prabhupada.